From stage plays to comic books, contemporary movie plots evolve from a variety of sources. Yet even now, the tried and true source remains books. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss two movies that were adapted from books. One, The Girl in the Spider's Web, is a continuation of the franchise begun in 2005 by the late Swedish author Stieg Larsson. The other, Beautiful Boy, is based not on one, but on two memoirs that details a young man's battle with drug addiction and how that battle affects his family. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Free your radio and hear Spokane Public Radio wherever you go when you listen live on your mobile phone, tablet, or computer at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Just click on Listen Live, pick your station, and start listening. Tune in anytime for NPR programs, local news, music, public affairs, arts news, and more at KPBX, KSFC, or KPBZ. You can listen to all three live from our website by clicking the blue Listen Live link at the top. Whichever station you choose, SPR travels with you, keeps you company, and keeps you in touch with the world. Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and listen live.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that, if it were a book, would no doubt be a bestseller, at least in our own households. Books are on the docket this week because they provided the source for the two movies that we're here to discuss. The first is The Girl in the Spider's Web, which involves Elisabeth Salander, the dragon-tattooed character created by the late Swedish novelist Stieg Larsson. The second is Beautiful Boy, an adaptation of David Sheff's nonfiction book Beautiful Boy and his son Nick Sheff's book Tweak. Let's begin with a bit of neo-Swedish fiction. Lisbeth Salander's first appearance came in the 2005 novel The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and she appeared in two screen versions of that book, the original Swedish production in 2009, and then David Fincher's American remake in 2011. Larsson died even before the first of the original trilogy was published, but since his death, the book series has been continued with the latest incarnation, The Girl in the Spider's Web, directed by Uruguay-born filmmaker Fede Alvarez from the book by David Lagercrantz. Claire Foy takes over the role of Salander, following the performance in the two Dragon Tattoo adaptations of Noomi Rapace and Rooney Mara. And Foy does a credible job, especially considering she's best known for playing Queen Elizabeth II in the Netflix series The Crown. The movie overall, though, feels like a cheap version of Larsson's work, with plot twists that depend largely on providence and Salander's computer skills proving to be better than those possessed by Bill Gates, Steve Wozniak, and those two Google guys all melded together. The Girl in the Spider's Web is a decent action film, I guess, but it can't begin to match the quality of what Fincher, in particular, put on the big screen.
Yes, and so then the question we ask here is, why make this movie? I think Nathan was gesturing.
I did a big shrug when she
said that. Yeah, right, exactly.
Which is great for radio.
Yeah, that worked out really well, yes. The books, I thought, were sufficiently compelling, but even those incarnations of this particular story became a little wearisome after a while. And so if this is at least the third attempt to put something from the series on the screen, I think they should have passed. Dan, you mentioned Claire Foy.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really imagine her playing this part, going into this particular role, even from seeing her on the trailers after her shining turn as Queen Elizabeth II in The Crown. She gave it a shot, but I think that she just didn't have enough to work with here. The script is, the good news is it's not really confusing. It's just kind of boring, I think. And that is a horrible adjective to use when describing an action film that is supposedly a thriller, because that's the last thing that you want when you go into the theater to see something such as this. The cinematography was workable, and I liked some of the vistas. Performances, fine. Just blah. That's my conclusion overall.
Yeah, and this was, as you mentioned, Dan, directed by Fede Alvarez, who I'm actually a fan of. He did the Evil Dead remake from about 5 years ago and a film called Don't Breathe, which I think is a really good kind of stylish, sleazy sort of grindhouse movie. And he is a great stylist, I think, first and foremost. And so The Girl in the Spider's Web does look really good. It doesn't look as good as a David Fincher movie, for instance, but that kind of goes without saying. I liked the way that this movie looked, but you're right, Mary Pat. I had a real hard time caring about anything that happened in this movie because it doesn't have a plot, really. It's just kind of incident after incident after incident. There's something involving nuclear weapons and this program that can apparently hack into all of the world's nuclear weapons, and whoever is in possession of it will obviously be the most powerful person in the world.
And that's the MacGuffin of all MacGuffins, isn't it?
It is. But the stakes of that situation are never really made as clear as it should be, which is weird because that's such an obvious plot
idea. Yeah, nobody seemed that tense about the whole thing, which was strange.
And then once it's revealed who's really behind all of it and who is the person kind of driving these deals, the plot is so murky and the characters never come into focus that the reveal doesn't feel like a reveal at all. It just feels like a, and then this happened next. So it's just strange. So it doesn't have that driving mystery plot that the original Stieg Larsson novel did. And those novels, you know, they were obviously huge successes. I read the first three, like I think everybody else did. I thought the first one was a really good kind of airplane read. And numbers two and three, I don't remember anything about.
A beach book.
But this is my problem with those books inherently, and we can talk about this, is that Stieg Larsson claimed to be writing these books about men who hated women. That was the original title of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo in Sweden. So he wrote these books that were supposed to be about sexual violence and sexual trauma, but I always found that he was kind of exploiting that to tell this sort of trashy B-movie plot, right? And this film, The Girl in the Spider's Web, doesn't have any of that nasty stuff that the original Millennium Trilogy had that always kind of gave me pause, because even though Lisbeth Salander is, I think, a really interesting character, in fact, she's almost a superhero in this movie, I always found the kind of exploitation of her and of...
Yeah, that's a really fine path, line here
and
to
navigate. And even though I liked both of the film versions of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I still kind of always had trouble getting around that. Going into this, this movie doesn't really give me anything to think about because there's not a story here. And
you know, I think that you have to, if we want to easily characterize this film in this series, it's a revenge film. She is trying to revenge every slight ever done to
women.
Yeah.
Well, because there is, and this is something we haven't talked about, there is a sense of her past coming back to haunt her in this film, because we see flashbacks to her childhood where, again, her father was abusive to her, although it's not nearly as graphic here as it was in some of the earlier films. In fact, it's off screen in this movie. But there is that sense that that childhood trauma has followed her, and the movie
and
kind of diagnoses her. And not just her. And so there is a sense of that. But again, we don't really feel the heft of that. And I don't know if it's because Claire Foy wasn't given anything to do. And this is the second time we've seen her in a movie this year, because she was just Janet Armstrong in First Man. And I thought she was great in that movie.
Sure.
And she was okay in this. But, Lisbeth Salander is such a good character. Why didn't the character come through this time around?
I think it goes back because it's based upon this reconstituted series that isn't – Stieg Larsson died – more than a decade ago, decade and a half ago. If we will recall, after he died, there was a fight over his estate between his father and the woman he lived with, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. How that's played out is that somebody has sold these rights to a publishing house, and they're just putting out these cheap imitations of a series that was a beach book to begin with. And how that applies to this movie is, over and above the plotting and everything else, it's just filled with sloppy, cheap plot twists.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, there's a scene in which Elizabeth, someone breaks into her apartment and he's shooting at her from about 10 feet. And oh, no, he only grazes her. Like
he couldn't hit the broadside of a barn.
It's the worst cowboy movie ever. What? Oh, he just grazed me. Just winged me. And then a bomb goes off and she just happens to be able to jump into
her bathtub.
A bathtub full of water. And that's going to protect her from all this fire. And then when the police come to escape, she jumps off the inn over a frozen lake and
on her motorcycle.
I mean,
and then later on, she's injected with a tranquilizer and framed for a murder. And she finds some amphetamines that happen to be on the kitchen sink, smashes them and snorts them, and then instantly gets up and is fine again, gets into a car and becomes a stunt driver.
Right, right. And on top of everything else, she is, as I pointed out, this computer whiz who can hack into the NSA, into anything, and all on a moment's notice, which is total crap.
And I also think that this film did not really benefit from some of the secondary characters. I mean, I never really got to know in Girl in the Spider's Web, I really never got to know the role of the other family members. I'll leave that a little bit vague. I thought that...
Or the chief bad guy, the blonde guy who played by Klaes Bang, who we saw in The Square.
Mm-hmm.
It's
right.
Like, I was hoping this guy would have a career, but this is not
not the way to go. Oh, and how about Spear Gudnason, who played Borg in Borg versus McEnroe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was sort of the antithesis of what I think about Blomquist, because he wasn't old enough. He wasn't sturdy enough. So that was just sort of, again, why?
And what about Lakeith Stanfield, who shows up as an American CIA worker
movie?
Or something? I mean, he's kind of on the margins of this story. He's sort of
he
following Lisbeth
NSA,
Salander
think,
around.
Yeah.
And that character also seems, I mean, he's basically just there to pick up all the threads of the plot that have been dropped.
Exactly,
and
especially
look,
with a sniper's rifle.
Yeah, and I mean, we're talking about the ludicrous nature of this plot. We've positively reviewed movies on the show that are way more ludicrous than The Girl in the Spider's Web, and often praising the ludicrous nature of those things. I'm a big fan of the Fast and Furious movies, for instance, or the Mission Impossible movies. And I think maybe if this film had leaned more into the ludicrous stuff, it would have worked better. But it
more
has
scenes
this,
like the snorting of the amphetamine off
has
the
this
floor.
Stern, it has this stern kind of, you know, straight-faced seriousness about it that is just totally at odds with how silly most of it is.
And I think that part of the problem is, and Nathan, you keyed on this earlier, I think the Lisbeth Salander character is a tough sell as a protagonist. Because, again, you're trying to figure out her gender fluidity. You're trying to figure out her backstory. You're trying to figure out, you know, as Dan was saying, is this really just a revenge flick? And as a result, each of the actresses who played her have played her slightly differently. But I think when you cut through everything, I think Noomi Rapace did the best job in terms of sort of capturing more of the essence of who this character is and should be. Rooney Mara was fine. Claire Foy, or at least this representation of Lisbeth, not so great.
Yeah. And that was The Girl in the Spider's Web. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at Beautiful Boy. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. Thank you. we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed The Girl in the Spider's Web. Let's now move to a movie based not on just one, but on two separate memoirs. The chefs, Father David, son Nick, are both writers, and it was their respective memoirs that screenwriter Luke Davies adapted for Belgian-born director Felix van Groningen. Blended together, the two stories make for a mostly moving portrait of a situation that has become all too familiar in America, a family struggling to handle one member's addiction to drugs. Father David, played by Steve Carell, though divorced from his son's mother, does what he thinks is his best to remain connected to his son. Son Nick, played by Timothy Chalamet, last seen in Call Me By Your Name, reciprocates his father's affections and even bonds with his new wife and their two young children. But then everything from crystal meth to heroin changes Nick from a loving family member to a stranger who will do anything for a fix. Much of Beautiful Boy plays with chronology, an effective stylistic touch that gives the actors ample opportunity to show us the ongoing angst broken by moments of simple joy. And those actors are good, not just Carell and Chalamet, but also Amy Ryan as the ex-wife and Maura Tierney as the beleaguered stepmom. Despite its obvious qualities, though, neither Davis or van Groningen, who directed a moving film in 2012 titled The Broken Circle Breakdown, weren't able either to get to the heart of what causes addiction or, worse, to concoct an effective ending to their movie. Instead, they simply let the story play out and resort to an on-screen afterword that feels like something you might see in the Lifetime channel or an anti-drug campaign poster.
Well, I was thinking about this all the way through Beautiful Boy, just the idea of making a two-hour narrative about an addict and about the nature of addiction, because addiction itself almost by its nature doesn't really lend itself well to the rigorous limitations of a feature film narrative.
Because unless you're doing Drugstore Cowboy.
That kind of breaks some of the narrative rules. And then this one does a bit. As you mentioned, it goes back and forth in time and jumps around a little bit. But either you adhere to a standard arc, in which case you're not portraying addiction realistically and you come across as pandering, or you show it as it really is, which is lots of ups and downs, lots of relapses and getting clean again, which can feel almost repetitious.
Betrayal of trust.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah.
And so it's tough to convey it, I think, in a realistic way. I appreciated Beautiful Boy for sticking more to the second approach, which is this movie is basically 2 hours of this person who is an addict, who continues to relapse, continues to find himself again, relapses again over and over and over again, and his family just struggles to try and keep him on the straight and narrow, and at some point realizes there's nothing we can do until you decide that you really need to get help and you need to get better. And that makes this a pretty tough watch, because that's just what it is. You have a hard time with this movie, I think, sitting through it because it is so tough. But at the same time, I liked the fact that, I mean, like is probably not the right word, because this is not a movie you like.
We say really. Appreciate.
Yeah, I appreciated the fact that it was honest about that, that it wasn't trying to really sugarcoat things. As an addict, I think that Chalamet's performance is really good. He does these things in his performance, these kind of subtle shifts in the way that he moves his body, the way that he talks. He'll sometimes slur his words a little bit, where he's trying really hard to make it seem like he's not high, but he is. He has these tells, and I thought that was really great. He doesn't make any physical transformation, though.
Right. That's my main problem with the movie. I mean, the movie is titled Beautiful Boy.
And Timothy Chalamet is a beautiful boy.
And he is a beautiful boy.
Named after the John Lennon song.
And he maintains that purity and handsome youthfulness throughout. And I'm sorry, if he really went through the hell of addiction, especially the meth addiction, his physicality would have changed dramatically. And he looks good, even when he's slurring his words, as you said.
Yeah.
He looks way too good in 90% of the movie,
I thought. Which is funny, because at one point, there's one sequence in which he's with a young woman and they're living out of his car. And you can see the transformation in her.
Right.
But you certainly don't see it in Chalamet.
Maybe the idea was, because there are people that live with addictions and nobody's the wiser, they're able to hide it. But he's homeless. He's doing every drug that he can get his hands on. I don't buy the fact that he would look the same. I mean, maybe that's a nitpick here, because I do mostly think that this film works.
What about that ending, though?
Well, I did want to get to that, because it does just end with text on a screen, and I'm never a fan of that. really anyway. But this movie, we've been talking mostly about Timothée Chalamet, but Beautiful Boy, despite its title, is mostly about the father, played by Steve Carell, and also a really good understated performance. And it's really about his own guilt and his own regret about his son's transgressions. Because Nick, the Timothée Chalamet character, he goes missing for a good chunk of the middle portion of the film, because that's when he's homeless and he's relapsed again after almost 2 years of sobriety. And the film kind of reverts to these flashbacks where Steve Carell's character is wondering, you know, could he have done anything differently when his son offered him pot that one time and he smoked it with him? Was that kind of a turning point? He's remembering his son before addiction kind of took hold of him.
He's not a perfect father. I mean, you know, he's got this second family, and I think he's probably a better father with these young children, with his second wife, Maura Tierney. But obviously there was a problem in his first marriage.
And his relationship.
And he shows anger every
His relationship with Amy Ryan, where they're blaming one another for things.
Right.
And that seemed realistic.
Right.
Yes,
and I think that I did appreciate the fact that this film does not really try to explain what went wrong, because I think oftentimes these things truly are inexplicable. Mm-hmm. And even though the Steve Carell character is beating himself up, trying to sort it out, I think that we don't learn why there was an addiction issue. I'm not sure anybody in the movie knows why there was exactly. I do think that the portrayal of how it feels, that amazing euphoria that you get, I thought Chalamet did a good job as Nick expressing that, because you can understand how somebody would want to feel that. I also liked the way in which the family dynamics worked, because oftentimes we see these blended families or these second families or the wicked stepmother portrayal. And Maura Tierney's performance of Nick's stepmother, I thought, was, you know, trying to protect her husband, trying to protect the younger kids, but still really genuinely caring about her stepson. And I thought that the filmmaker did a nice job with that.
Yeah, I mean, even though the movie focuses on the Chalamet character, the son, and Steve Carell, the father, it does give more time for both the women characters to have some screen time, as opposed to just being, oh, yeah, they're there taking care of the kids.
Actually, one of my complaints with Beautiful Boy is that the two female characters didn't get enough to do.
Well, no,
Because whenever
they got more than normal.
I suppose. I mean, that's kind of damning with faint praise, I suppose. Whenever Amy Ryan or Maura Tierney was on screen, and by the way, this is a movie with three actors who have just aged very, very well. Like, everybody in this movie is, it's not just the beautiful boy. They all look great.
They're beautiful people.
Right.
And their homes were pretty darn beautiful, too.
You know, at first, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. But it is kind of a nice little commentary on the fact that just because you're doing well and because you've aged great doesn't mean that your life is perfect. But anytime Amy Ryan and Maura Tierney were on the screen, I thought, I want more of them. I want to know more about them.
I agree.
I want to know how they're dealing with this, as opposed to how they're dealing with this through the Steve Carell character. And there's a really lovely scene near the end of the film. It's really Amy Ryan's first big scene, where it's her and Timothée Chalamet. He goes to L.A. to live with her for a while. And there's a scene where they're together in his dorm room or in the college common room or something like that, that I wanted more of that. I thought that they are sidelined a little bit too much, I think.
And I think that is because it is the guy's story at the
heart
of it.
No, it's true. This is a father-son story, but I think it does discount the two maternal figures a little
bit. All right, but last word on that ending. Come on. The movie doesn't end. We find out what happens to the characters, and it was like, wait a second. There's 8 years here that you're just going to throw away? Come on.
I agree. A nice little epilogue, or maybe even footage of the real people. We don't even get pictures of the real figures, which is something a lot of these based on
are
fact films
to do.
Yes. Yeah, but I agree. Ending a film with just text on screen about serious
issues.
Seems
like a cheat.
Yeah, I'm never a huge fan of that.
No. And that was Beautiful Boy. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed The Girl in the Spider's Web. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, when we'll again brave the world of contemporary cinema. Until then, remember these words from the late Stieg Larsson. There are no innocents. There are, however, different degrees of responsibility. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.